consumers' relationship with money is very bad. Mm-hmm. We are not able to think about money in the same way as we should, because mm-hmm. everything about money is long term, but we are wired as consumers or human beings and, you know, our monkey brain to think short term.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Mind Gravity Podcast. Today on our show, we have Nitya Sharma, CEO and co-founder of Simple. Simple is a technology company that offers pay later solutions in India. Simple has revolutionized online checkout in India by creating a market-leading pay later platform, empowering e-commerce merchants to offer their consumers one-click checkout, a line of credit at point of sale, or POS, and full buyer protection. A little bit about Nitya. Before starting Simple, Nitya worked on Wall Street for more than 10 years, where he structured, traded, and risk managed structured credit portfolios at Bear Stearns and Goldman Sachs. Before that, he was co-founding portfolio manager at JNF Financial, a distressed credit hedge fund from 2010 to 2014. Nitya decided to move back to India with the objective of starting an emerging markets focused hedge fund. But he experienced the shortcomings of the Indian payments and credit stack firsthand when his credit card application was declined. We have been through so many of those cycles ourselves in our lives when we are applying for our first credit card. This experience, however, prompted him to dig deeper into the Indian payments landscape and subsequently led to the founding of Simple. So without any further ado, let's tune in to the podcast with Nitya. Welcome to the Mind Gravity Podcast, Nitya.
Thanks, Ron. Excited to be here and look forward to talking to you and your audience.
Yeah, no, you've been too kind for accepting the invite to come and talk to me. You're the founder and CEO of Simple. And where does this podcast currently find you?
I'm in Bangalore, India. Been in Bangalore for the last 4 months and more or less in the 2 mile vicinity of my house for the last 4 months. But yeah, I'm in Bangalore right now.
Brilliant. I mean, that's not too far away. It's probably, what, a 20-hour flight from San Francisco?
That is true.
But before we dive deep into Simple and what you're doing with your startup, let's go a little back into time and learn a bit more about you, how you started, and what was your journey all the way till you founded your startup.
Absolutely. So my background is I grew up in India and I went to undergrad here, and ended up going to grad school in the US. Basically, I studied quantitative finance, got a job on Wall Street, where I first worked at Bear Stearns in New York, trading mortgage-backed securities. Then I was at Goldman Sachs, trading more of mortgage-backed securities and structured credit correlation. And then I was a hedge fund in New York also. And around 2014, I kind of decided I want to be an entrepreneur. Felt that I would start my own hedge fund because, you know, when you've done finance and investing for so long, you feel that that's the only thing you know. So I thought I'll start my own hedge fund. And I was just taking some time off. And I was in India visiting my parents and so on. And basically, one thing led to another that led me to start Simple. And the starting point was my bank in India rejected my credit card application, in spite of the fact that I had a banking relationship with the same bank since almost 2000. So we are talking about between 2000 and 2015. I had a relationship with them. I had a student loan with them. I paid off my student loan, etc. And they could not give me a credit card. So, you know, that kind of like led to a series of events that got me to start Simple.
No, that's so relatable because I've moved so many countries throughout my life as well. And every time I move to a new country, I'm having to establish a new banking partnership, no matter whether I'm in US or if they have the same presence in some other part of the world. It's always a new transaction. And that's so frustrating.
On that point, Rohan, yeah. I sometimes ask people this question, this very basic question, which I feel is quite an aha moment. If I ask you, right, as a young millennial, you know, that person, how many times have you changed your email address, your personal email address, or your Facebook account, or your Twitter account, or your LinkedIn account in the last 10 years?
Barely.
Meaning, you just have one, right?
Just had one. And just, I mean, I've tried to segregate email probably a little more, just to segregate the spams versus more professional or anything along those lines. Facebook, same. Twitter, same. Nothing really much has changed unless someone asked me to change because of security reasons. There's no going back. Yeah.
Right. And how many times have you changed the actual address of where you live physically in the last 10 years?
Oh, at least 10 times, if not more.
So that would prove the point, right? Your digital identity is a lot more permanent than your permanent identity itself, you know? So we are in a very different world and financial services hasn't caught up at all.
No, that's case in point. I love that example and how you walked me through that, through my own examples. Yeah, you're totally right. Your digital identity stays put. And I think that needs to be brought into the financial services as well. And that's what you're doing with Simple. So tell us a bit more what Simple is doing.
Yeah. Before maybe I tell you exactly what Simple does, maybe how we stumbled into the idea.
That'd be even better, yeah.
Cool. Because I think that'll explain what Simple does automatically. So, you know, I got rejected for a credit card in India, in spite of the fact that in the US, I had my Platinum card and two other cards and all of that stuff. And when I looked around, I realized a bunch of things and saw a bunch of things that were happening in India that got me to start Simple, which is the first thing, very few people in India have a credit card. Mm-hmm. So only 29 million unique people even today, compared to 500 million people who have a smartphone, has a credit card. So, you know, the credit card market is incredibly underpenetrated. So that's number one. And the primary reason are twofold. The first is credit data itself. Most countries like India and emerging markets do not have the type of credit data that US has. So credit data is a massive barrier to entry around credit card penetration and consumer credit penetration to start with. That's one. The second is the operating model of credit cards. The cost of customer acquisition on a credit card business model is incredibly high. In the US, for instance, it's about $500 to $600. In India, it's about $150 to $200. When you're spending that much money to acquire a customer, your TAM, the amount of people you can give this product to, is just constricts itself.
Yeah.
Limited, right? Anyways, so in India, only 29 million people have a credit card. So saw that. The second thing you see in India is this very interesting phenomena around consumer retail, which is consumer retail is very clearly and very quickly moving to the internet, to the mobile. Yet 70% of all people still use cash to pay for what they buy.
Right.
So you see that. One would think the reason people use cash is that there is a financial inclusion problem. People do not have payment instruments or bank account or that type of stuff, which is often thought of in emerging markets, right? People, you know, it's a fairly generic assumptions people make. But the reality about India is that India is now the most, probably the most, not one of the most sophisticated banking infrastructure in the entire world. And that was obviously done by a lot of work by the government and a lot of public entities. And this is what I mean by that. This means that every single person in India has a bank account. Every single person.
Right.
So 950 million people have a bank account. They all have a debit card. Therefore, everybody has a payment instrument.
Right.
Yeah. They all also have access to what is called UPI. UPI stands for Unified Payment Interface. And for the lack of better analogy, it is like the ACH of US, except it's real time, 24/7, and no cost.
Interesting. Right? Okay.
1 billion people in India has digital identity, which means they have what is called Aadhaar, which is US, US style social security number, except it is, you know, on the internet, verifiable online, and has biometrics on it, right? So when you think about the country and the market, you see this incredible leapfrogging of technology and consumer behavior in retail, yet the instrument people use is still cash, right? So you ask a fundamental question, why do people use cash?
Right.
Because clearly people have the bank account, so that's not an excuse you can give. And the reason people use cash is it is the best user experience compared to all other user experience and payments that existed in the market for consumers. And the reason consumers love cash, especially in e-commerce, is it solves two very important consumer problems. The first is it enables trust in a transaction.
Right.
So think about yourself, right? You live in the US, you probably have a debit card, you have a credit card. And if you're putting and saving your card details online, you'd rather put your credit card than your debit card because your debit card is your bank account. That's where your salary comes, your savings are there, a lot of money is there.
The money is gone. Yeah.
Money's gone, right? It's your money and it's your problem and then good luck with the bank, right? And credit card, on the other hand, comes with a lot of buyer protection, right? So if there is fraud, you'll call the card companies like you take care of it and they typically do. Right. If there's chargeback, there is dispute, you know, a good credit card company will help you solve for it. And credit card comes with a lot of buyer protection. At least when I was living in the US, that's what I thought, right? I mean, I put in my Amex card and I will never have to worry about any problems, right? Mm-hmm. Now in a market where there is no credit cards or familiarity with credit cards, but there is debit cards, you can kind of like very easily understand why a consumer would just use cash on delivery to solve for that problem. Because what does it mean, right? I'm never putting my debit cards online. I will never have fraud therefore, right? So that's easy to understand. Mm-hmm. When you come to my house, I will give you money, right? It feels very easy to, you know, that's how we buy things offline. So why not online as well? And you know, it's easy to understand why consumers feel safer with cash, right?
Right.
The second and equally important reason why consumers use cash on delivery is this UX problem around checkout in India, which is if you check out on a website or on a mobile phone, every single transaction that you do with a card, credit or debit card or UPI, has to go through what is called two factors of authentication.
Right.
Okay. So imagine this: you put your debit card online first, then the bank will send you a password each time, one-time password on your SMS.
Right.
Which you will then fill up on your website,
Uber,
Amazon, small, big, doesn't matter, right? And it has to be not done one time; it is done each single time that you are doing the transaction.
Gotcha.
Right. So imagine the user experience, right? You are used to Amazon one-click checkout, and once you're used to that, it's so hard to go back. But there is no such thing as one-click checkout in this problem with infrastructure itself, right? Because of which, a lot of user experience problem happen. People transactions fail. 20% of all transactions on mobile phone just fail. So now imagine cash on delivery, one-click checkout, conversion of the card. Second, builds trust. So why would people not use it, right? So, you know, that was a thesis. That was my understanding, and it continues to be so. Yeah. And you can imagine this with merchants, right? Merchants want to offer what consumers want to have, right?
Right.
And if you were to distill it down to first principles, they're not asking for cash. They're asking for trust and convenience.
Sure.
Right? Yep. And trust is the medium through which they get it, right? But to process cash on delivery is incredibly expensive for merchants, right?
Right.
It is a de facto credit book you are running. There is fraud, there is returns, there is reverse logistics, all sorts of issues that could come with cash. And you know, that was a problem in the market. So now when I was looking at it around 2015, and honestly, at that point, I was not really, you know, thinking about starting a startup like in payments and so on, because as a regular consumer, what you see as payments is really the tip of the iceberg. There is such a complex value chain that has been around for 50 years that kind of like exists. But I got kind of like fascinated, right, with this problem statement. And I started, you know, I felt in the beginning there is an opportunity to build a credit card issuer in the country. So think about a Capital One of India. Around that time, there was a very interesting startup getting started in Brazil called Nubank. And I thought there was an opportunity to, now obviously Nubank is a very large company, thought there was an opportunity to build a Nubank of India, which basically means at a fundamental level, a credit card issuer, right? You're giving people credit cards. And I thought maybe I should do that. Again, I was a little bit of a reluctant entrepreneur. And as I was thinking about doing it, I started wanting to learn about payments. Like, what is this thing like that called? Yeah. Credit cards, and how does it work? And what is Visa? And what is MasterCard? And networks and so on. And I spent some time learning it. And obviously, it's a fascinating world of payments. But two things I learned that was my aha moment to kind of like, you know, then I jump into your fundamental question. Was this two realizations, which I think, you know, as a consumer, as an entrepreneur, when you realize it's I think pretty powerful. The first is this thing that you call the credit card that is sitting in a pocket right now, that you use in San Francisco, was built in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And almost nothing about it has changed since then.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Except it used to be paper. Mm-hmm. Now it is mostly plastic. And the greatest innovation that is coming on credit card is metal, right? So the only thing that is changing is paper to plastic to metal. And everything fundamentally stays the same. The product is the same. The product experience is the same. The business model is the same. Yeah. And the value chain is the same.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you know, you kind of like obviously sit there here in India and I'm sure anywhere in the world, and you say, well, we're living in a world where there is smartphone, unlimited compute power. We are all connected to each other. There is crazy amount of data, and we are all buying on the smartphone. You know, I'm sure there is a way to reimagine this whole thing, right? I mean, like, what is the next version of this? Fundamentally, not how do you build paper to plastic to metal, but like, what is the next leapfrogging? So obviously, you wonder that. And then second thing is, I think, to me, at least more powerful, and I think fundamental to commerce, which is this realization that when you swipe your credit card, so when you look at the revenue chain and how's money made, when you swipe your credit card at your favorite coffee shop across the street from your apartment, and you perhaps go there twice a day, you'd realize, if you look at the math, that credit card or that coffee shop guy or any store you go to is paying roughly 3 to 3.5% each time you buy a coffee from them, right? And if you want to break down the unit economics, right? Like, okay, well, there is capital here, there is risk, all of those things, you'd realize 2% out of this 3.5% is going towards your loyalty points.
Right.
Right. Which is a big driver for credit cards, right? I mean, like, we all love our loyalty points. But who is that loyalty point building loyalty to?
Yeah.
The bank.
The bank.
Issuer of the card. Mm-hmm. Right? Who's paying for it?
Right.
The small coffee shop merchants across the street. And yeah, the SMEs, the mom and pops, the Americans, right? Why?
Right.
There is no real reason. Well, it's really good for the banks, right? Yeah. You can imagine why it's good for the banks. And consumers definitely like it, right? But consumers do not realize one thing, which is hidden in plain sight in front of their nose, which is this, the second realization I had. When you think about the US market and in ratios, it is true in any market, whether it's India or Japan or Australia or Kenya, which is this thing. Take US for a second. $3 trillion are spent on credit card every year.
Right.
Right. So if you think about the market size, this is the biggest market you can imagine for any markets, right? I mean, $3 trillion is real money. And a lot of this money is spent for your coffee and your dinner and your little shoes and your, you know, all these things we all buy.
Extravagant shops, yeah.
Yeah, our daily lifestyle, right? You're not going and buying some iPhone and a computer every day, right? Or like a washing machine, right? So these are your daily things that you're swiping a card for. And 40% of this $3 trillion every single year is revolved as balance.
Balances, right.
So whenever you are tempted to, you know, leave that minimum payment as like the default outcome, it's a trick. It's not good for you. It seems like good.
You're essentially paying for it.
Well, you're not paying for it. You're paying for it and committing financial suicide. You're paying 24 to 36% interest rate. Okay. On paper, it looks small because your balance might be, you know, let's say $3,000 and they're asking you to pay like some $150 on minimum. So from a, you know, consumer's relationship with money is very bad. We are not able to think about money in the same way as we should, because everything about money is long-term, but we are wired as consumers or human beings and, you know, our monkey brain to think short-term. So we feel that this $150 is the deal we are getting, but we do not remember that 24% is what we are paying. If you do the math on a spreadsheet, the basic math of compounding, anybody would realize this is the worst idea in the world.
Right.
You will never get out of it, right? No one should be financing the coffee at that type of interest rate, right? But that creates a $250 to $300 billion revenue stream from banks in the US, and similarly for banks in the US, around the world. Right? Why would banks not want to have it, right? So when you, again, like the fundamental point here was that when you think about this credit card value chain, right, there are these payment companies and then there are banks. These payment companies, when you put them together, it's a $1 trillion market cap ecosystem.
Right.
Right. And banks are huge, as we all know, like several trillion dollars of market cap. And they are all in this, the way this ecosystem is stitched together, adversarial to merchants and consumers.
Right. Totally.
Right. Right. They make money when we lose money.
Of course. So there were a few questions I just sorry to jump in between is from more around the human behavior perspective in this case, which is pretty interesting because most of the startups, whether it be fintech or large banks, they're going towards simplifying the retail process or the purchasing process for the user as simple as possible. But I think in hindsight, we don't realize the more easier it gets, the higher we spend. And we have seen around the world, like US, the amount of debt the US consumer has. Same thing has happened in Korea. US actually banned peer-to-peer lending because they saw this, shark attack was essentially happening on its consumer, whether through WeChat or Alipay and so forth. That why there is such a push to use the end consumer as a clickbait mechanism, right? You're asking them to come in and then...
It's a good business model.
Hmm.
So let me give you an example. There is a book recently, I think it recently came out, very recently actually, I just read it. It's called Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. And it's kind of like a interesting book on psychology, human psychology with respect to money. And one of the kind of like anecdotes in the book, which I think we all know intuitively perhaps, but was quite heartening to me, and I think that'll answer your question, is when you think about the US lottery market, lottery ticket market, it is larger than all of digital entertainment, all of digital gaming, and all of digital things like we all look at, put together, okay? 75, I think the number is 75-odd% of that market is household, US household, under $12,000 annual income, right? And we all know gambling is it works for the house, right? It never works for you. Yet we all gamble, right? And whether you are higher income or lower income, but it especially appeals to the lower income and it's worse for the lower income because our mind tricks us. Our mind says, hey, I'm buying this ticket for $10 or $3 or even $1 every day. And really thinking that I'll become a millionaire. And most of us don't, but it just feels good, right? Mm. We are all about instant gratification.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah.
And any gain anybody makes, whether you are an entrepreneur or a person who has a job or you want to invest or save is about long-term, right? As Warren Buffett says, or I think it's Charlie Munger, one of them. All of us can have six packs and be a billionaire or a millionaire as long as we go to the gym every day, or kind of like just compound our money, right? And except we all want to trade in the stock market and we think we are smarter than everybody else and like make the little money, which is why some stock trading apps would make a lot of money because it's great, right? I mean, like it feels good to gamble and like that excitement. Similarly, we all want to have six packs and it's easy. All you have to do is eat healthy and go to the gym every day. But we also want our hamburgers and like...
That's the hardest part, right?
Yeah. Sit on the couch and like watch Netflix. So that's the reason. Human behavior is very hard to change. A lot of infrastructure is built to make money around it. I guess necessarily there is nothing fundamentally wrong about it. Not to despise it, but yeah, we believe there is an opportunity to build a new infrastructure for money, for payments, for buying, which actually works with the customer. Like, look, in the end, right? If the customer is given the right amount of disclosures and transparency, visualized in the right way, people will do the right thing for themselves, right? I think that's a problem. It's less about whether people are what does people do, but it is easy to get people to think there is some short term thing to gain. But I think if that same customer is shown information, shown the type of transparency in the right way, I think they will make the right decision. And I think we are already seeing a lot of shift there. And we can talk about later in the podcast, but buy now, pay later, and the stuff that we are doing actually tie into that theme where consumers are,
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I've been seeing this trend for ages at this point where everything is kind of hidden in the footnote. Because I also remember when we touched earlier about the credit card, the APR that you have to pay, which is like 25 to 30%. Like initially, well, when I was in college, I had no idea what I was doing. So I had by default set up into, you know, paying the minimum payment. And that just struck me after a few years, realizing that I was not going to be able to get out. But that was an intrinsic motivation to get out of that cycle. But yeah, I think bringing more transparency into the system is much more needed. And you were talking about buy now, pay later. So Affirm and Klarna and all these companies have started to make it much more transparent and open for users to enjoy the experience that they're doing without actually having to make them feel that they're missing out on some information. So I think that's a great journey you described so far. So identify two problems in the market in India, and then you decided you want to build simple. So tell me a bit more, like, what is Simple trying to do to make consumer, merchants, and all the players involved in the business and making their lives easier?
Yeah. Simple enables consumers to buy things online, especially focused around mobile commerce, where the frequency is very high. So, you know, you buy food online, you buy grocery online, you buy movie tickets online, you go to the office by taking a ride online, etc. So we are focused on that use case. And what Simple allows the consumers to do is buy now, right? So you press a button and you buy something and you pay for what you buy in an aggregated bill once in 15 days. So what that means is that you buy food on one of the vendors we work with, let's say Zomato, then you buy grocery at Big Basket and you buy, you take a scooter to the office at Bounce, and then you buy movie tickets on Book My Show. And then you take you buy something else from some Dunzo, which is hyperlocal commerce, etc. You can buy, press a button, easy one-click checkout. Don't have to pay. No financial information online. So you know, trust, security, etc. is all taken care of. And once a 15-day period is done, at the end of 15 days, you get a bill that you pay off, just like your charge card. So it's a one-click checkout. So it's easy. It's convenient. It's beautiful. It's fast. If you've, you know, I'm sure you've done Amazon one-click checkout. Simple is at least 5 to 10 times faster than Amazon one-click checkout. And the reason is there is no one in the middle. Like, you press a button, boom, it's done, right? So it's very high-quality consumer experience. And you can do that across the internet in India, at least for now. And then you get a bill and you pay out that bill. And in a nutshell, it's like a charge card.
Gotcha. So there's been a massive trend towards the embedded finance. Does that kind of fit into that overall scheme? And for the listeners, just to explain a bit more, to have like an Uber experience where you get into the ride, get out, but you don't have to worry about paying. Is that the direction that Simple is trying to move towards?
Yes, it's very, very much like that. And, you know, while embedded finance is a kind of like a new buzzword, I think that's going on around in the valley. But it's really the most original version of finance that is known to humankind. And let me tell you one small story and how we, you know, actually founded Simple and like really what our product stands for. So, you know, when, you know, I told you the problem realization, right? I mean, like there is an opportunity to just reimagine this whole thing, but the starting part is very hard, right? I mean, like obviously, you know, at scale, this makes sense, but how do you even start, right? And like clearly, you know, there are incumbents and networks and value, and like a lot of people want to make money through this. So in India, what happens is, so I live in Bangalore, and I live in a building, and there are a lot of stores near me, right? There's a milkman, there is a newspaper guy, there is a grocery store, there is a liquor store, there is a dry cleaning guy, and there is a pet store. So these guys are where me and my wife, my family goes fairly often on a daily basis to buy stuff. And without exception, all of them run a tab on me. Tab as in house account. In Hindi, it's called the khata, right? It's very common,
right?
So, you know, that happens. And of course, I grew up in India and I've lived on khata, right? I grew up in a very small town back in the day before I moved to the US. And we had a khata with an overhead store. My grandfather had a khata. The whole family bought it. My dad, my grandmother, my mother, etc. And you know, I've lived on a khata, and I'm here in like 2015 with my smartphone, with the internet, with everything else. Yeah. And this guy is literally writing what I'm buying on a notebook on his thing. And I jokingly call it distributed ledger, right? This is the original distributed ledger. And of course, as I was thinking about payments and I was, you know, becoming a payment entrepreneur, you know, obviously when you look at it, you obviously ask this fundamental question. This is the credit card of India, right? It's already here. It's been around for centuries. And I'll tell you a very interesting story. And here the book, I ended up reading a book, you know, if you are your, it's called 5,000 Years of Debt. And I ended up reading this book around the time I was thinking simple and, you know, a lot of serendipity was happening at that time. I'll put it as a prop, but what this book argues is for 5,000 years, people have traded with each other on a khata or a tab.
Right.
Tab is older than money itself, right? The money, the currency, right? And you know, obviously, when you look at it in India, you kind of like, you know, as an entrepreneur, you're like, well, but this is the credit card of India. It's already here. It's informal. No one is building it. No one is productizing it. No one is branding it. No one is giving loyalty points. No one is doing anything about it or to do with it. Yet, it works in big cities like Mumbai and Bangalore. It works in the smallest of villages.
Right.
Rich people use it, poor people use it, middle class people use it, old people use it, millennials use it, and it's been around for thousands of years, right? And so you obviously ask the question, right? There must be something fundamentally right about it, like from an anthropological perspective, right? To reverse the anthropological origin of, I guess, money that you pointed out. There is something that is going on from the history of humankind that must make it very interestingly embedded into commerce, right? And the question is, what is that, right? And can you distill it down? And if you can distill it down, can you use that to build the next version of it, right? Was the question I asked. And when you distill it down, you know, two things really jump out. The first thing that jumps out is this fact that in the reason the merchant gives the khata to their customers is because they want to build a relationship of trust with them.
Right.
The reason my newspaper guy or my milkman gives me this khata is not because I don't have money or I need a loan or any of this. It is this original embedded finance. He gives me a small line of credit so that I build a relationship with him, and therefore I go back and buy stuff from them.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And you know, when you think about even the origins of credit cards, that's how it started. Right. Mm-hmm. It was original embedded finance, which is Macy's will give it to you or Walmart will give it to you or some retailer. It was a store card. Right. So store credit, as they call it. Right. So, you know, that it is understandable why the merchants give it. So that's number one. The second is on the consumer side. You know, the experience of buying on a tab is the best experience of payments you can imagine. Right. If you were to, right? There is no payments at all, right? Totally. One thing we say at Simple is that the best payment experience is no experience.
Right.
No one ever came to a store or to a mobile application, to a website, to a restaurant, to a coffee shop saying, hey, I'm going to Starbucks to make a payment today, right? Mm-hmm. No. You go to Starbucks to buy coffee and so on, right? And the best experience, therefore, has to be no experience. And the question is how close you get to it, right? And you know, when you have the realization, you kind of like say, well, if you were to take the concept of the khata, right, and reimagine it for the world of internet and make it interoperable so that the consumer gets one bill for everything, right? Yep. So I'm not getting, so today what happens is though my milk pal is giving me a bill once in a while whenever he feels like, and they, you know, all these guys. And
they're maintaining it on your own ledger.
Exactly, right? It's like it's way too distributed, right? For consumers to consume, right? And that's the problem with anything too much. You know, that's why you need bundling, right? You know, this thing doesn't work unbundled, right? So bundling of the bill, right? All the ledgers into one ledger and then one bill for everything, what we call, which is why consumers would want to use it. And then on the merchant side, if it is on a network where the network is responsible for identity of a customer, fraud, managing fraud, and managing risk, right? Risk, that obviously is great for merchant because no merchant wants to be, you know, even the embedded lenders don't want to be lenders, right?
Right.
They want to be the brand. They want to be the kind of like the front end of like consumer experience and you know, the thing. And if you were to put it on a network, the network would solve for, you know, identity fraud, all these things that are the negative aspects of any credit product. That sounds like an interesting way to reimagine absolutely a new version of a credit card network or platform, right? And while doing so, you do it in a way which is actually very beneficial to both merchants and consumers, right? Not just to financial services companies and you know, I think it should benefit anyone everyone, but not at the cost of one of the other, right? So that is what Simple is all about. We believe the opportunity that we are working on is to reimagine payments, right? This whole payment thing that we discussed that is not working for merchant and consumer, to make it work for merchant and consumers and do it in a way which is, you know, like I guess embedded finance is a new word, but I mean, there is an anthropological origin to it, right? People buy from places, they don't come there to pay is not the thing. And if in that process of buying and paying, you kind of like help them establish trust and relationship through easy checkout, credit when people need it, and loyalty points that enable merchants and consumers to build loyalty with each other, that is exactly what a credit card is.
Correct. Right. Yep. No, so I love
and that's what we are trying to build.
I love how you broke down the entire problem set that you've had and how your journey and your experiences, and you're absolutely right. I think first of all, like finance or just finance solutions, institutions in general are a very trust-based business, right? But for centuries, even they haven't really changed from their existing business models, one-to-one relationship with branches and just the paper money being pushed from back and forth. And then the other point that you brought about is that no user experience is the best experience, because and 100%, I don't go to Starbucks thinking that how do I pay? That's a friction added into my experience overall. If I could just go in and just come out and not worry about payments, that would be the best thing ever. And I think Amazon Go is probably coming closest to that no user experience kind of a scenario. And I think that's brilliant. But I think what I find more curious about now is like you identify the problem, but obviously it took you a while to come up with this iteration. So as a founder, initially when you start off with a specific problem set and you're solving for it, and then you eventually stumble upon a product that you call an aha moment or a product market fit has been achieved, what does that journey look like?
Yeah, no, I think there is a long valley between aha moments and product market fit, honestly, because that's where, you know, a lot of things go wrong. Aha moments are just like a very intuitive understanding of something and then translating it to a real product. And obviously product market fit means that is now scalable as well as, you know, you can make money and create a business is what they call the valley of death, right? So yeah, it's been quite an interesting journey. We've been doing it for more than 4.5-5 years now. For me and our company and our team, the journey has been exciting, obviously, but challenging at the same time. Right. The reason it's challenging is we are solving some very hard infrastructure problems, right? Which is hard to do, but when we do it, and I think at this point we have done a lot of it and it's always ongoing, you know, that becomes your moat. That becomes your business defensibility, because it's really hard to anybody to replicate. You can be the biggest tech company in the world, like Google or Facebook. You just have to go through the rite of passage to get here.
Totally.
And the problems you're solving in terms of infrastructure and market creation is, first of all, you're building a two-sided market, right? You're building a network of merchant on one end, and then you're building a consumer base on the other end. And to get started is chicken and egg, right? Classic chicken and egg.
Yeah.
You know, on the merchant side, we now work with over 2,000 merchants in India. Some of them are very large internet companies. Actually, a lot of them are very, very large, the biggest category leading merchants in India, et cetera. But obviously there has been a journey, and I jokingly say about this type of market creation that the first 10 merchants are impossible. Mm-hmm. The next 100 are very hard, but the next 1,000 is easy, right? So it's always this journey in creating networks where there is a tipping point where, you know, first you are really hard and like it just seems like you need to give up, and then you eventually have a little bit of traction, and then boom, it turns over. And I think we are at that point. Then of course, you are trying to figure out how do you deliver this product in a way where you don't not only have a market, but there's product market fit. And from a user experience point of view, or you know, not quite business model, but just like people want to use it, right? So you know, you are iterating a lot on the product side, on the merchant side, and then of course on the consumer side. And the data you are looking at is retention, right? Are people using you? Are using you a lot, and then using a lot more as you create the network, right? So
right.
It has its own iteration. You are adding features and et cetera. You're learning. Some of your hypotheses are true. Some of your hypotheses are false. Right. But to me, and you know, a lot of times you're confused, right, as an entrepreneur. And that's anyone will tell you. But I think what really helps you in this journey is, are you right in your fundamental beliefs, right? That belief that the best payment experience is no experience, right? Is that, or is there a data that is suggesting that is not true, right? I mean, that's what you're always looking for, right? Similarly, from a merchant side, are you correct in your heuristic that merchants want to build a relationship with the customer? If the answer is no, then something is wrong with your product and you have to pivot. But if that is right, then you know you want to keep on that journey and like move the envelope and like figure out how to get there. And fortunately, you know, I think that we were spot on that first principle of, you know, what should be the future of the role of payments in commerce in the future, right? So I think that's where we were right. But of course, there have been journey. So consumers, how do you build like a product that consumers actually want to use from a details point of view? And then third is how do you make sure you have unit economics, right? What is your business model? And in this business, the unit economics is all about how do you manage fraud and risk, right? And that is a non-trivial problem to solve from data science, machine learning type data science point of view, from operations and design, right? What we are saying is there's an opportunity and the right way to solve this problem around, you know, credit and commerce and the intersection of two is not only to kind of like establish credit and so on, but also very importantly, design for trust, right? And you need to communicate for trust and almost like build what we call the network of trust, right? And of course, there is heavy engineering work in the background. There's heavy data science work in the background. And access to data that is proprietary in nature, right? So it takes a lot of time to kind of like get your ducks in the row and like, you know, the right ducks in the right row type thing and the thing. And honestly, there is no playbook for it, right? This is not like something you say, hey, look, somebody did it, let's just copy paste. So yeah, it's very much driven by a lot of fundamental level problem solving and also really understanding second, third order of consequences of what you build, which really helps you, you know, get to that intersection point.
I think it's very much an experiment and trying multiple different things to see not just which one sticks, but which one holds true under stress test against your first principles and the vision that you have, right? Which also like makes me move to my next question is, you are one person. You obviously have multiple different ideas that you want to test. How do you make sure that the idea that you pick is the right one? And what is the role of the team that you build around you? And I guess the extended question to that is, how do you make sure that you have the right team member for the right job?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. So first of all, 90% of what we have done, 99% of what is the team, right? It's not really me, right? And that is so true. It's all about the team who has three basic qualities, in my opinion. One, they believe in a mission and a vision of what we want to achieve as a team and as a company, and you know that vision is something that is obviously far out, right? 5 years out, 10 years out, sometimes 20 years out, right? And it's hard to abstract that out, right? So that's where I see a lot of my work comes to kind of like clarify what this means, right? Mm-hmm. And then a team who is then able to distill it down into a quarterly roadmap, right? What do we do today and like next month and like therefore the next 3 months, right? Having that clarity of what is a North Star? What is a vision like 5-10 years out? And what is the chess moves we want to play, right? So, you know, having a clear visualization of your end game In chess, it's super important to know your beginning game and your middle game, and therefore your checkmate, right? And you know, how do you take the next step, right? So it's all about the team, right? The team is the one who is not only helping come up with the right strategy and the next move. And of course, you know, a lot of moves are wrong moves, and you die and like move on, I think. But yeah, I mean, like the thing, and then of course the team that has the right skills. You know, and the team that works together in a highly trusted manner, right? So setting up that culture of trust and people really working together has been the most important learning I've had in not only creating the company as well as creating the team, so that right. You know, people are having the right roles for their both skill as well as, you know, what we need to do, and of course having people who are passionate about the vision at the same time. Directing the passion into a focused strategy as opposed to, you know, scattered is quite a challenge in company building, I think. And I think, yeah, it's been, you know, we've made our mistakes. I think we are on the right track now, I feel. It's been ups and downs, but it's been exciting. But one thing I'm very excited and proud of right now, and always been proud of at Simple, is we've had an outstanding team. Again, this is a non-trivial problem to solve, right? As I said, you know, solving for fraud and credit and two-sided marketplace in a hyper-competitive payment market like India, et cetera, is very hard. And you know, having the team with the right skill and singular focus and directing that focus into a cohesive strategy and then executing that one step at a time is the only reason why we are here. Of course, we have made our mistakes around the line, but I think I believe very strongly that all around the journey and right now, we have probably the best team from around the world who is solving the problem that we have in the most optimal manner we can solve right now.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I think team matters a lot. It's not a one-man job. And if the war has to be won, you don't have to worry too much about individual battles being lost, but the right battles need to be won along the way as well. That's brilliant. I know we are running short on time, so I have a couple of more questions before we are able to end today's session. I mean, it's been an amazing conversation so far. But one question that comes to mind is, like, for an entrepreneur or an investor or someone who's looking outside into the Indian fintech ecosystem and you being so close to it, what are some of the things people should be aware of, or what are some of the things people get wrong about the Indian fintech ecosystem in general?
I don't know if it is about India or otherwise, but I think what people have gotten wrong, in my opinion, sometimes is, and this is less about fintech, more about everything else, definitely also in fintech, is it is fairly easy and from a first order of consequence point of view, come up with strategies that work in other markets, right? So if something happens in the US, it should happen in India. If something happened in China, it should happen in India. If something happened in Indonesia, let's just the copying or kind of like replicating a playbook that works somewhere, and like you have a few billion dollar companies and like, let's do that, I think. Definitely happens in India, and I'm sure it happens everywhere in the world. And I think in India, especially in fintech, the reason why that probably does not make sense is lot of infrastructure problems in India. Like at a, you know, when you think about infrastructure, right, you are kind of like looking at, you know, the most fundamental plumbing type infrastructure, and then the next level and the next level. The most fundamental plumbing has been already solved by the government, right? So the Plaid of India, the whatever, all these things of India is already there, right? And it's public right. APIs, right?
Yeah.
So I think of this as the internet of money, right? That's a beautiful part of India, right? When you think about the bank account, is the server, right? There is money sitting in it. UPI and Aadhaar and what is called the India stack. And a lot of things have been built and are working at scale. And a lot of things are being built and probably will work at scale. Are really that fundamental level infrastructure around, you know, just like data moving, money moving securely and so on, right? And therefore the opportunities in my mind are really the next level of infrastructure and then user experiences, right? So the next level of infrastructure are, you know, intelligence, right? How do you use this data now and connect all these pipes to create intelligence and system of intelligence that just, you know, solves for risk, fraud, that type of stuff, right? And then on top of that, you're building all the value, which is user experience, right? How do you then translate this plumbing and then system of intelligence and the internet, everything that, that is around us? Because people don't consume data science and machine learning. Mm-hmm. People don't consume the internet. People don't consume UPI. People don't consume Aadhaar, right? People consume what? The best experience is no experience, right? Sure. And they, the question is, how do you stitch all this together and give it to the consumer? Right. And I think therefore the opportunity set in India is, I think, one level up from infrastructure and then closer to the user experience. The way I explain sometimes is, by the way, this is true in most emerging markets in India, right? If you think about US, right? How did entertainment evolve? Let's call it like TV and so on. We were going to Blockbuster and like buying our cassettes, and then that cassette become TV, and then there is the dish antenna came, and then HBO and Comcast and all of that, right. And then eventually Netflix got started with like mailing us the CD, and yeah. Now we have Netflix, right? What is Netflix, right? Netflix is taking all the advantages that internet gives us, right, on the back end, and giving us one thing for $10, and like you can, it's prime time all the time, this thing. But the journey in the US was, you know, Blockbuster and this and that. And you, I don't know if you remember DVR, right? It was a way for people to record all that DVR type stuff. In India, none of that, right? We never had the Blockbuster. We obviously have some small little stores here and there where you can rent CDs and stuff. India leapfrogged to Netflix. Hmm. On day one, right? You don't need the instruction anymore, right? The instruction is here, right? The internet is here. People have the TV. People have all sorts of stuff. You can just give them the user experience. And of course, Netflix is a great user experience, but all the complexity in the back end is the value that they build.
No, I think that's absolutely fantastic analogy. Yeah, no, that's fantastic analogy. Like, you don't have to go brick by brick. You just have to identify what color paint the house should be and how your lawn should look like and so forth. No, that's brilliant. One more question is, like, now you have described the entire pain point and the journey and the problem that you've seen and what matters most to you and where you see a simple going as well. What was, looking back, what is that something that you would want to change or do differently?
Oh man, if I come up with a list of the mistakes I made, as I think about evaluate myself personally and some of the, you know, things I would change, because that's the only thing I can, I should think about for the most part, are some of the decisions you make and how fast you make those decisions, the speed of decision making, right? When you are innovating and you are inventing, really there is no 100% guarantee of what you're about to do. And therefore, there could be a lot of analysis, paralysis, contrarian decision-making, a lot of non-consensus decision-making. And sometimes you just need to have the right frameworks to do those things, right? Because otherwise it's easy to get lost in getting consensus done and not be putting the right people at the right task. So I think I would do that differently. I've made wrong decisions. And when I think about when I've made my wrong decisions, it's never because I move fast. It's always because I move slow. So that's number one. I think as I've learned, I think a lot of entrepreneurs have talked about it. And as you build a company and you read these books all the time, and the second reading is always more interesting, that you knew when you read the book that these are the things people say. But you forget when you are actually executing. And then when you make the mistake, you're like, this was the thing. How can you move faster? And like, how do you have a framework to make decisions? And, you know, Jeff Bezos and Reed Hastings have talked about it, which in retrospect is just like basic common sense, which is, you know, there are reversible decisions and there are irreversible decisions, right? Mm-hmm. Reversible decisions should be made decentralized and move fast and like just make it and make people in charge of making it who have the right amount of, you know, that type of mental balance, that when they see themselves making a wrong decision, they don't have the ego coming between them and the decision, they can actually reverse it, right? And that's because oftentimes you don't know what will happen, right? And then there are irreversible decisions, right? Really big mistakes you can make, which is where you want to be really deliberate and perhaps it's better to be slow. But the reality of business is there are only three or four or maybe two things you will do in a year, which would be irreversible decisions. But most of the things you are doing are reversible. And you know, how do you speed up the process? How do you build the org structure to kind of like make sure you move fast there? Second is the team itself, right? I mean, like, I think it's underrated when people say you have to bring people smarter than you all the time.
Right.
And you know, as an entrepreneur, both from like being able to run a company as a CEO and preserve your own sanity, where you're just not doing everything. It is, you know, only when you smart hire people smarter than you, you realize what that means. And you know, it's a, you know, the reason why it is hard to execute is not because it's hard to hire people who are smarter than you, because, you know, you can always convince people. It's emotionally hard as you know, people in the company, leaders, CEOs, and early team members to kind of like give away your responsibilities, right? Where, you know, when you on day one, everything is yours, right? Like what you do, right? And then still it becomes a little harder emotionally for you to choose, just trust someone else, right? Because it's your baby almost, right? But yeah, it's a baby. It's one of those babies that requires other people to grow, right? For me, those I've been learning, of course, just like any other first-time entrepreneur, I've made more than my fair share of mistakes. And both, I wish I made decisions faster. I wish I hired smarter people than me faster, etc. But I guess it's a journey, and we are very, very, very happy where we are right now in terms of the business, the product, the opportunity, and our team.
Yep. No. And hindsight is always 20/20. Only when you get the time to reflect and see the things you made wrong, you say, "Ah, okay, that makes sense." And to the other, it's like, yeah, it always takes a village to raise a child as well, and it's hard to give away your own child to raise. But this has been brilliant, Nithya. Really fun conversation. There's so much insights and so much value for anyone who's listening to this. But before we end our episode, where can all our listeners reach out to you if they have to?
Yeah, I'm on email, Nithya, Nitya, at getsimple.com, getsimple.com. So it's get simple without the E. So you can reach out to me there. I'm on Twitter, Nithya Sharma. Just search me on Twitter, Nithya Sharma. Simple, you'll find me. Would be happy to hear from your audience. I always find Rohan when I talk to smart people, whether it's a podcast or a customer of ours, or an investor, or just a competition. My own thinking gets better. Happy to hear from your listeners on where some of the assumptions we are making are maybe challenged, should be challenged, and would love to hear that.
Absolutely, and I'll have all that information in my notes as well. And I'm pretty sure a lot of people will be really excited to see how you're changing the, you know, the fintech ecosystem in India, and what amazing things that you're innovating and continuing to disrupt that market. Again, thanks so much, Nithya, for the time to talk today, and really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ron. Nice meeting you. Right. Take care.
I was mind blown by the ton of insights that I've had through that podcast and learning more about the Indian fintech ecosystem. If you enjoy this, and if you continue to listen to this podcast, please do share it with your friends and family. But this is the end for our podcast segment today. Until next week, namaste.